So we're gathered here today. This is July the 16th, 1990. And we have been we're here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the Alaskan Polar Regions Department. It's been a beautiful day. And we have with us Doris Southall, and myself, David Hales, and Philip Lely. And Phil is a descendant of Felix Pedro. Some time ago, he did have an interview with William Schneider on October the 23rd, 89. But Phil tells me that since that time, he has found additional information which is different than some of the information that he gave to Dr. Schneider. And so I think, first of all, we'll turn the time over to Phil to talk about some of the things that he'd like to correct in that tape that he supplied to us at an earlier date.
Well, to begin with, Dominic Pedroni was Felix Pedroni's brother, and that was my great-grandfather, so they can understand my relationship. And the only reason that I'm really involved is no one in the family took up the cause to kind of find out Felix's history, so I guess I was kind of chosen to be, by self-appointment, the family historian. But before, when I talked to Dr. Schneider, my grandmother had told me that Felix Pedro had came to the United States in the same way that her father had, Dominic. But I found out that Dominic Pedroni, even though it was accurate for him that he came here as a indentured worker, that Felix Pedroni had earned enough money and had came here on his own. And he was not brought here with an indentureship to work out. So actually, when I said that he went to Illinois to be an indentured worker, he actually went there for 2 years to be Felix went there for 2 years to be a section hand on the railroad. But it was a job that he secured in this country, not one that he'd came here to do. And that was the biggest inaccuracy that I had my grandma had told me. If I found this out from some translations that I was able to get a hold of in the last year. So that starts out the story of the wrong way when I started it out with Dr. Schneider. But Felix Pedroni you want me to just tell you about what I... Basis.
Sure, why don't you go ahead and...
Felix Pedroni was born on April 16th, 1857. He was born in an area called Philomo. And Philomo was about 60 miles west of Bologna and about 40 miles south of Murda. And that's in the north-central part of Italy, on the east coast of Italy. And it's a mountainous region, about 2,000 to 3,000 feet in height. And today it's a farming community, and it hosts winter sports. It's a vacation area in the wintertime.
Have you ever been back to that part of the country?
No, but I have a bunch of tape of it, videotape. And my wife isn't in good physical health, so that's one of the reasons that I've never been able to go there. But I still hope to one of these days. I've had relatives go there and do some videotaping and so on. At any rate, it was a very, very poor part of Italy, and so people were migrating away from there in droves during the time Felix was growing up. And in fact, his brothers and his dad had to leave in the wintertime, and as soon as he was old enough to work, he would leave with them. In the wintertime, they would go down into the lower part of Italy and even to some of the offshore islands to do farm work and any kind of job they could secure just to make a living, because there was just no way of making that type of a year-round living in the area where he was at. I might as well start out with making the one correction that Felix Pedro was the name that was given to him when he came through Ellis Island, and his real name was Felice Pedroni, F-E-L-I-C-E, P-E-D-R-O-N-I. That was his given name in Italy, and the name actually he's buried under in Italy today. At any rate, some of the things that he did while he was was working in Italy till he was old enough to come migrate to this country. He worked as a field hand, he worked as a shepherd, and he worked with his father. They gathered wood and made it into charcoal, and I was told at that time that they used to use a lot of charcoal to cook with, and it was a common thing to sell charcoal wood. He left Italy in 1881, and the attributes he brought with him was enough to get him to this country. And a good he was in good physical condition, and because of hunting and so on, he grew up as to being really a good marksman, and that was one of the things that he liked to do was hunt. They both served him well. His first job was 2 years as a section hand in Illinois, and he lived with some Italian people there and was able to learn to speak English enough to where he could converse after that without too much problem. Then he was a miner in Colorado and in Utah. Then he moved to Southern Oregon, where they had a small gold strike. And in Southern Oregon, he, I guess, got the idea that gold you could prospect for, and that was one of the things that stuck in his mind. In 1888, he came to the Carbon River coal country in Washington, about 60 miles east of Tacoma, and my grandfather, great-grandfather Dominic, had already homesteaded there in an area called Edgewood, which was about 50 miles from where Pedro got the job in the coal mines. And that was one of the reasons he came there, was to be by one of his brothers. He was a kind of a fellow, as far as a personality goes. He didn't drink. He didn't really care to gamble or carouse like that. He was a very down-to-earth individual, but he did like to, which was a popular thing in those days, assemble at the barber shop or at the village store or something and sit there and reminisce about Italy and about the things going on, and that was one of his hobbies and one of his pastimes. Also, he liked to hunt, and in this coal country where he settled in this Carbonado, they hired him as a coal miner, but it wasn't very long, and they used him as a camp hunter, which was a fellow that would go out and shoot wild game for them to feed in their bunkhouses and in their to their miners that they had in these bunkhouse setups, and he did that for about a 4-year period of time. During that time, he met a fellow named Hanat. And this Hanat befriended him, and actually was the one that set him up with what they called it a grub stake, I guess, where he was able to go up first to northern Canada to the gold strike in the Caribou country and tried his best, which he failed. He came back to Carbonado again, and then he took and made a little bit of money and got another grub stake from this Hanat, and in 1894 he went to Alaska, and he was in and out of Alaska for the next 8 years until he discovered the gold on Pedro Creek and Goldstream. Those are two creeks located near Fairbanks here. About 3 weeks after he found the first gold, he spotted some steam coming up from the Chena, I think that's the way it's pronounced, is it Chena Slough? And when he walked over there, it was about 17 miles, he found that this Barnett had run aground with a riverboat, and this Barnett apparently was trying to get the riverboat up past this area, but Pedro told him he had discovered some gold, and so Barnett elected to unload his boat, and that's, I guess, how the city of Fairbanks became exactly where it's at. It was a combination of this Barnett running aground and Pedro telling him that he'd discovered gold in this area that they elected to set up their trading post and so on there, and that's where Fairbanks came from. He, during the next couple of years, he went out and got some Italian immigrants that he knew in the Carbon River country and in another coal area there in Washington called Rosalind, And he brought him up here to work in the mines, working his gold claims. And he also gave them 50-50 shares where they'd work a claim of his and he would get 50% and they would get 50%. And some of those Italian names are still here in Fairbanks today. I was even told by one old prospector, one old gold fellow that had worked up here with gold with Pedro, his name was Nate Speroni, that he influenced the fellow that has the big coal mine down here, Isabelli Coal, the fellow named Emil Isabelli, I believe it was, who was the fellow that came up and started all the coal. He came out of Roslyn, and because many Italians had migrated up here out of that Roslyn coal country to work with Pedro, that kind of stimulated his thoughts to come to Alaska. And he, when he came up here, he knew several of the miners that were in the Fairbanks area at the time. So he played a part in bringing a lot of Italian immigrants up here to Italy, from the Scarborough River coal country and the Roslyn coal mines. In 1906, he went out to Tacoma, Washington, and married a woman named Doran. Mary Doran was her name. And while he was there, he was married in a church called St. Leo's Catholic Church, which at the time was a missionary church. And there was the fellow that married him, Father Hylibus, marriage certificates. Father Hylibus, and Father Hylibus was a missionary priest in that area where there's many things named after him. So it was kind of ironic. Here he was coming out, and this missionary priest officiated at his wedding.
Now, I have a news release from a Fairbanks paper in 1905 saying that Felix was going back to Italy to marry an old sweetheart. Did you ever know anything about that?
No, I certainly didn't. And Mary Doran was from Ireland.
Right.
And she had been here in the Fairbanks area, and he had met her here. Mm-hmm. And when he went out to Washington, he took her with him, and they got married in Tacoma. And one of the reasons was because, again, Dominic and his family was there. And then he built a home, and he bought a 20-acre piece of ground in Edgewood. In fact, I'm having a heck of a time finding it, but he must have had to take permits out, and I'm looking for those now that he had to take out to build the home. Even then, they had permits. And I'm trying to find out more about, you know, what was behind it, why he did this. But
well, this Fairbanks Evening News for July 18, 1905, the headlines read, Felix Pedro sails for the outside after an old sweetheart. And then it tells, we'll visit his native land and expects to return on first boat in spring. I can't read the rest of it, something after. And it tells here that he's going back to his native country to bring home a bride.
Well, he in fact, if you look on that marriage certificate that I gave you, you'll see that the woman was from Ireland. She was.
Right, I've been trying to do some research on Mary Pedro myself, so.
Yeah, I haven't been able to get any. It's very difficult to find his. I've had a couple of friends that are good in research. One of them used to be the professor of history at Tacoma Community College, and they're trying to find his immigration papers, which again will have a lot of information. I also, there's a priest that's going through the old archives at St. Leo's Church, there's a whole bunch of information that those two marriage certificates don't have on them. For instance, when you get married in a Catholic church, they want to know where you were baptized at. They want to know who baptized you. There's several different items that will lead you on to other things, and they're searching for that for me right now. In fact, I hope it's found by the time I go back home.
So you've never heard anything about him going back to Italy to try and find
him? He did go back to Italy, but that was after he married Mary Doran, I think her name was.
I'll give you a copy of this news release because that's
I'd appreciate
about
it.
Going back there to try and find her, to marry an old sweetheart.
Well,
this would be about a year before he married Mary, because this was in 1905. He married her in 1906.
Well, when he married her, permit to build the home, it'll tell you on the permit, you know, when he applied for it and so on. But the home was built around 1906, so it was about the time he was out there that he bought this 20 acres of property, which was kitty-corner down the street from his brother Dominic. And he built the home, and in 1908, my grandmother bought the home from him. My grandmother and grandfather bought the home from him, and I believe for the price of $800, but at that time, I guess probably that was what it was worth. And then as a little boy, I grew up, and in the summer I spent a lot of summers at that same home. It's since been torn down about 3 or 4 years ago, but it was there for many, many years, and it was the Pedro home, and I was told that story over and over and over again. Pedro was a real hero within the family, and they used to talk about him an awful lot. And one of my uncles, the one, there's a Felix Lely, and he was named after Felix Pedro. When he was born, Pedro had died 2 years before my uncle was born in 1912, and they named him Felix after Felix Pedro because he was such a name within the family. But,
Well, do you have any more information at all about Mary? Did the family ever talk about her, or?
I'll tell you what the family said about her, but it's very inaccurate, I think. But they didn't particularly care for her. They said that she, the first thing they told me is that she was a dance hall girl, meaning that she was of ill repute, I guess, and that she was taking Pedro for his money. And then there's a funny thing that happened after he died. For a very short period of time, he was buried at Clay Street here in Fairbanks. And nobody that I've ever been able to talk to, or no story I've ever read, ever tells he was exhumed shortly after, and within a couple week period of time, and sent to be buried in San Francisco. But my grandmother told me that the reason that that happened is that Mary Pedro had poisoned him, and that she thought that they might exhume him there and find out that he'd been poisoned with arsenic, is what my grandmother said. And that was the reason that he was shipped outside. And then there's a story in that packet I gave you by a fellow named Stanford Patty, who, when I first talked in about 84 to Frank Young here in Fairbanks, Frank told me how inaccurate the story was, and that it was just a figment of this guy's imagination to sell newspapers, is the way Frank put it. And he talks about the body being missing for a period of time, and that there's a mystery to all this. And it led a lot of people to believe that there was something that was done that was less than honest, and that was what had happened to Pedro. But when I talked to Nate Speroni in 1952, he told me that Pedro died because he did not take good care of himself, and that he got pneumonia, and he died of pneumonia in this hospital here in Fairbanks. And Frank Young told exactly the same story, that he died of pneumonia. Yet there's other stories in there that are written about him dying of heart problems and so on and so forth. But those two actually knew Pedro and were at his funeral when he was buried, and they both tell the same story. And it's not too hard to believe, because in those days pneumonia was a very serious thing. It was before the sulfa drugs and before penicillin and so on, and it wasn't unusual for people to get it and die very rapidly from it. So all I can do is make judgments on what I hear. I don't believe my grandmother's story to be accurate. I believe it to be just a figment of their imagination, primarily, I suppose, because they thought there was a lot of money involved in Pedro's claims and his mining and so on. And Frank Young told me that he thought that when Mary Dorn sold the claims to the Hunnut brothers, that she got like something like $3,000 a claim or something for it, which was a lot of money in 1910 or 11, because $3,000 would have been at least 3 years' pay for a professional worker at that time. So if she got, say she got $12,000-$15,000, she would have gotten a lot of money. By today's standards, it would mean nothing. But she did remain here in Fairbanks until she died in 1931, and I've never taken the time to look up either, and I'm sure they're easy to find, I should do that while I'm here, either her or Felix's death certificates, because there can be certain information on there that can lead you to other things. But she emigrated from Ireland, and that's all those papers that I gave you have the 1910 census in there. And the 1910 census said that she was born in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I think she was about 4 years younger than Pedro, according to most of the reports. One made her 10 years younger, but I think it tells when he died, the account in the Fairbanks paper said she was 4 years younger than Felix Pedro. So, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of another as to why these things happened. But there is some more information I'm going to get. This friend of mine, he's involved, he's not a Mormon, but he's involved with the Mormon Church in research, and he's going to Salt Lake City, I think, in October of this year. And apparently their archives are fairly accurate, and he's going to do some research in Salt Lake to see if he can find any more about Pedro's death and about... And I'll have him take a look up for him about Mary Dorn, and if I find anything, I'd be more than glad to send it up to you.
I also have a notice from the paper in the Nahum Gold Digger, January 30, 1908. And at that time it said that Felix was being sued by his wife for a divorce.
I've read that in some of the other things, that they weren't getting along very well, but... Yet they were still married in 19, and that's probably another reason my grandmother thinks that there was some skullduggery, because they didn't get along very good together, I gather, and it's strange. They're both listed as first married too. See, she would be, when Pedro got married, let's see, he'd be 48 years old, and she would have been 44, and of course, I'm sure they wouldn't have married him if they had been married. If they would have said they'd been married before, maybe he preferred to get married in the church, and maybe the woman did lie about it, I don't know. But they both are listed as first time married, and her at 44 years of age and him at 48, which would be highly unusual, you know, in those days, I suppose, for people to wait that long to get married. But again, I'm looking for the records. And if I get the records from the church where they had to fill out about their baptismal and so on and so forth, that will tell the parish in Ireland where she was baptized. And again, that's another source of good information.
Well, she also had nephews that lived here in the Fairbanks area. I've got reference to that.
There's a nephew that came in here, according to Frank Young, the nephew came in here after Pedro died. He kind of helped her, I guess. But according to Frank, the way he talked about the fellow, he said that he was kind of a do nothing type fellow that was kind of expecting to live on her inheritance or the money that she had assumed, because Frank knew the fellow, and he said the fellow liked to party and to do things, spend money, but he didn't like to make it. Now that's Frank's assessment of this guy. And I can't remember his name, but he told me the name too. In fact, I might have wrote it down on some piece of paper someplace. Again, I haven't spent much time looking too much about her, but...
Well, I've been kind of interested in her because we've had questions about her before, because there's some much that's written about him. His picture appears every year at Golden Days Time in the newspaper, and so we have had people who have asked about her, and so I've been kind of interested too, but I haven't been able to find a lot so far.
Well, the only thing that I know that's both in both things it says the, both the marriage certificate and the 1910 census both tell you that she was born in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the two, now maybe if she would have been here in the 19, there wouldn't have been no 1900 census in this area because the area didn't exist then. So it would be a matter of, and Pedro in 1900 was in some place in the boondocks of Alaska, so he wasn't listed in the 1900 census any place. But my biggest, there's a building on Sandpoint Way about 2.5 miles out from the University of Washington where one of six in the United States that house all this information on microfilm about there would be Pedro's immigration papers, and we've been over there 3 or 4 times looking for those, but we haven't been able to find them because they're not properly cataloged. But if you just happen to be lucky, you can find them because they'll be there. But I've never looked for anything about Mary Pedro.
Now,
I think I have a copy of that.
This record of June 15th, 1903, though, states that her his name was John Doran, and that he and Mary Pedro had run John Wood and his friend John Vance away from the something plant at Discovery in Pedro Creek. And they had to go to court about it.
Well, then apparently,
it was before
Frank realized they were here, because he talked about the fellow showing up after. Now maybe the guy was here before, and maybe Frank just didn't click with him, because mm-hmm. Frank was he was 92 the first time I ever talked to him, and sometimes you know his mind he's got a very very sharp mind for a man his age, but I'm sure there's things that he. In 1905, that Frank Young came here to Fairbanks. He was 11 years old. And he peddled the papers out on the diggings. He first came to Fox, and he would ride a bicycle down the paths they had then and peddle the News Miner. He told me he sold it for 25 cents a copy, which if you talk about 25 cents, according to the wages they were making, that had to be a very expensive paper. But that was what it sold for in those days. And then he talked about moving into Fairbanks and living next door to Felix and Mary Doran. His dad had a house right next door to him in Fairbanks. And so he knew Felix Pedro pretty well. He met him out on those diggings when he sold papers. And then he remembered him, of course, living next door to him. And then Frank Young was also an older boy, and he would, he'd be 16 years old. He was an older boy. And in Pedro's, someplace in those papers I got there, it tells that he was buried by Father Monroe, and that Frank not only remembered Father Monroe's name, he went in and he got a piece of paper, a little book that Father Monroe had given him on instructions on how to be an altar boy. He still had that. It was quite interesting. But as far as Mary Doran, again, I'd like to know more about her myself. I am curious.
You never seen a picture of her?
Never seen a picture of her. There was never any around. If there were, my grandmother destroyed them. But she had a deep hatred for that woman. And my dad, another funny thing, I had some relatives go back to Italy just this last year to Falarmo. And Felix Pedro's brother, his name is Felici, I think it is. He's the next younger brother to older brother to Felix. He's one brother older. He has a nephew, I mean, he has a son that's still alive in Italy. The son is close to 90 years old. And they went and looked this fellow up. Now, he spoke nothing but Italian, so they had an interpreter there. But the first thing he said about Felix was about this woman that poisoned him. That was the first thing that he So it was spread through my side of the family pretty well that this woman was everything bad that you could think of. And even he, after all these years and having never seen anybody from this country, they went back there. That was the first thing he wanted to know about, was this here terrible woman that had poisoned his Uncle Felix. So, and again, why Mary Doran, that would be the key to a lot of things, is why she took and had his body exhumed and taken to San Francisco. There doesn't seem to be any real reason for that. In fact, the records, there's an article in this thing that tells about she bought four burial plots and didn't pay enough money down to pay for the first one. But all four were held because you'd put this money down on. And when they were talking about Felix being 50 years after the gold strike, well, they did some research to find out where he was at and found his grave sites and everything. There was never a headstone on him. The graves were never paid for, and nobody else had ever been buried there. And there was never any contact with that cemetery. They tried to send bills, apparently, but they'd never been able to contact her again. So it's kind of strange as to why this was ever done. And if a person, I suppose, knew that riddle as to why she took him outside, she'd probably have a lot of insight on exactly what she had in mind. But in 1910, I suppose you could have got by with a lot of things. But the two fellows that I talked to that actually knew Felix Pedro told me that they both had the same story about him having pneumonia, and pneumonia would be, I'm sure, a good killer at that time. I'd love to know the rest of the story, but it's just, there are about three or four women that live in the central part of the United States. Their husbands have died, and they're none of them named Pedroni, but that are of another brother that came to the Detroit area. And he had these daughters that married other people, and their names were changed, and then some of them are granddaughters that have different names. But there are no Pedronis, to my knowledge, at least as far as we can contact, except in Italy, left of that family. Every year we have a Pedroni reunion, and there's about 75, 80 of us now in our area, but primarily named Lenti and Lelli, which were my grandmother and her sister, both, one married a Lelli and one married a Lenti, and the family got kind of divided, and that's the only relatives that would be in this country outside those four women who again, their names aren't Pedroni, so there's no Pedronis left in this country.
So, but it was a common topic in your family to talk about Pedro and Felix and Mary.
Mary, every time it came up, it was, my grandmother used to look down her nose and say, "That woman, she poisoned him." I mean, I heard her say that lots of times myself. And my uncle, I had two uncles besides my dad. My dad never talked about it very much, but the two uncles used to talk about it. I used to hear him talk about this woman poisoning their uncle, their great uncle. So it wasn't an uncommon story. But again, there's no way of telling. I've never read an article that ever said that there was some doubt as to why. But then I read stories about him being exhumed and taken away, but there's never any explanation for it.
A few years ago, there was apparently there was a woman who came to Alaska to visit, and who was supposed to be, I think, it was the daughter of one of the friends of Felix Pedro's, and she also brought an article that was given to a woman out in Anderson, Alaska, Jean Murray, and we had the article translated, and basically this person was saying that Felix Pedro was not the one who discovered gold in Alaska, and that they claimed that he got all the credit for it, but it was really someone else who discovered the gold.
Well, that's, anything's possible. It doesn't seem very probable, but because he wound up with the gold claims that he had. Of course, in those days, anything could happen, I imagine.
Now, I'll give you a copy of this article. It's kind of interesting. An Italian woman did translate it for us, but she claims that it was not...
She didn't say who it was, though.
Yeah, his name is not to read through this, I haven't read it for a while, but I'll give you a copy. I think it was Giovanni Del Costa.
Well, Del Costa, now, there's some names that he went out of.
Okay, well, Costa is the last name. It's Giovanni Della, and then Costa. I'll give you a copy of this. It's kind of interesting anyway. Someone didn't want Pedro to get the credit and said that he got all the credit, but he shouldn't have gotten the credit. It really, the credit went to somebody else. So how old do you think you were when you first heard about Felix Pedro?
Well, probably about 5 years old. At first, my dad lived in Tacoma, which was 9 miles from where that house was. And then about, when I was about 2 years old, he moved to this Edgewood area where the house was, where Pedro's house was. And I probably started hearing it then, but I don't remember the stories until about 1934. There was a period of time when I had a grandfather that was had mental problems, and they'd taken and bring him home for a while, and he couldn't hack it. So my grandmother used to talk about Pedro then, and I think it was a lot of it in reference to where she had some money, she could do something about the mental condition my grandfather had and all the hardships she was suffering at the time. And I suppose that even made it more embittering that she thought there was tons of money at when they talked about Pedro, they talked about as if you would think of him as a multimillionaire. Well, in those days, if you'd had $1 million, you'd have been like a billionaire now. But they kept talking, and it was like a guy that caught a fish. The more he talked about it, the longer the fish got. Well, the story got the same way.
Why do you think you became so interested in trying to find out more? And you seem to be the only one in your family that's really had this great interest. What do you credit that to?
Well, I used to tell people that about him being the discoverer of gold, and then they'd ask questions, and then that would stimulate my mind, and I would ask my uncles, and they would just reiterate the stories they'd heard. And so I just believed that. And then, 1975, I got involved in writing a book about the history of the Tacoma waterfront. I'm a longshoreman in Tacoma. And I had a tremendous experience trying to put a book together. It's a long story, so I won't go way into it, but I told some people that were supporting the idea about how much it took, and they gave me the money. Well, then I found out later it took about five times that much to write the book, and I ended up getting involved with a bunch of different people from the University of Puget Sound, the PL Pacific Lutheran University, and from this Tacoma Community College. because I had to get a grant, and I had to get people involved that were understanding on how to get grants and had some ethical reason as to get them, more so than a longshoreman. And so they got me interested in the history of, when I told them about Pedro one day, they got me interested in why, you know, what do you know about him? Well, I really didn't know that much. So one of them located Alaska Lynx, and through her, I had conversations with this Renee Bahuta, and I came up here and talked to her and Alaska Lynx. I met this Frank Young through them, and the more I talked to people, the more interested I got in it. Other than that, up till then, it was just casual information. If somebody told me something about Pedro, I don't have the greatest memory in the world, but I can remember things rather well if there's something I want to remember. And I remembered things that I'd heard about him. So the more I dug into the thing, the more I got interested in it. And nobody on my side had put together any kind of family reunions or anything, so I started having them to my particular house. I'd invite the whole family, the Lentys and the Lellys, and the uncles, one uncle was left still then, and so on and so forth. And I'd talk to them about it, and some of them became interested, but in a reverse way. What did you find out? Never follow, look, and try to find anything. They want to know what I found out. But it did stimulate one part of them to going to Italy to look up where the Pedros had lived and discovering this great, the nephew of Felix Pedro. And again, he suffered from the same thing my grandmother did, just some passed on down stories that led him to believe that this, I'm sure if he would have drew a picture of Mary Dorn without ever seeing her, she would have looked like some kind of vampire or something, because that's the way he believed it. And they had passed these stories around, and I suppose each time they passed them, they added a little bit to them, just like they do with stories. But even him, it was really surprising when he said to him, that woman that poisoned Uncle Felix. And he believed that. And his grave, I've got some videotape of his grave and the country around where he was raised. It's about like Fairbanks. It's, you know, rolling hills and no big steep mountains or anything, but it's a winter resort area now, but it ranges 2,000 to 3,000 feet above sea level. And if you saw the country with the small trees and stuff in it, it doesn't look too much different than Fairbanks does. So maybe it's just ironic that it looked that way, but maybe that's the reason he liked it here. I don't know.
What can you describe the house for us that was there in
In Edgewood?
In Edgewood.
The house
that belonged to that
season. Yeah, I can. I'm not any good at drawing, but I'll just kind of make it look what it looked like. It was a house, as in those days. There was a great big porch. In those days, a lot of houses were built with a great big outdoor porch. It had a porch that stretched all the way from the kitchen door, the front room door set here, all the way around like this. And then inside, there was a set of, you go into the kitchen. This was an outside storage area here. It wasn't part of the inside of the house. You couldn't, you know, you had to go outside. It would be like a fruit cellar, you know, kind of a thing. And then you went inside the house, and there was a stairway leading upstairs like this here. And there were three bedrooms upstairs. It was divided into three, a hallway. I think the hallway came right down through the center. And there was a bedroom over here, and then a great big bedroom here, and the third bedroom was across the whole front. And then there were some storage closets and stuff over here on the second floor. And it was a, I would say the house was probably 25 by, say, 50, you know, a long, narrow house with this porch exaggerating the width of it so that it didn't look quite as narrow outside as it did inside. And it's on the lower floor, on the floor was like this here. This was all front room across here, and there was a kitchen here and a bathroom laundry area here. And there was just about three rooms on the first floor. This was a great big area where they could eat in here if they wanted to, like when we went there for big dinners and stuff. You ate in one side of the front room, and the other side served as the sitting area for the front room. And then behind the place, he had built a small little building like this. It would be set back over here
which was a cream place where you separated the milk and you did that. That was had a cement floor and stuff in it. And then just beyond that was a fairly good-sized old barn with a big hip drift like a lot of the barns in that area did. And it was rolling, not rolling, actually rather even steep, the property. Went up a little bit and then down into a kind of a ravine, but it was level enough to graze cattle and stuff like that on. And on the front part of the place, when my grandmother had it, where the house was, the house was about right here. This was all berries all around the sides of the house. She raised raspberries and stuff. And beyond the barn, they had this acreage that was on this hill, and they raised cattle and separated milk. And she made cheese and grew gardens and did everything she could to make a living. When I was a little kid, she'd give me a nickel, like say, when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, say around 1938, 39, 40. She would give me a nickel, and it was the worst thing she could do for you, because for 6 months she wanted to know what you did with that nickel. I mean, if you were foolish with it or not. You know, and she used to brag about her kids never spending a nickel, never spending any money. And that, to her, being frugal was a way of life. I mean, it was a tough life, there was no question. She was sent to this country, this grandmother of mine, when she was 14 years old to work in a bunkhouse like a bull cook type, cleaning the cabins and stuff for the areas they lived, miners lived in. And when she was 15, her dad told her, who was there with her, he told her, he says, "You're getting married and that's your husband." She never even met the guy or nothing before. And she was 15 years old when my dad was born. And the husband she married was 25 years old. But her dad just said, "That's who you're marrying, or I'm not having any more problems with you. That's the end of that." It's kind of a hard, tough existence.
Don't you have a happy marriage?
No, not really. He'd been injured quite a number of years before that, and he was kind of a...
Well, my grandfather was hurt seriously in an accident with a tool called a farrow, which was dragged behind horses, kind of like a miniature bulldozer, and he got some mental, some brain damage apparently, some head damage, and later it resulted in him having to be institutionalized, and I think he died in 1934. But my grandmother had kind of a miserable life and was always very frugal because she had to be in order to make a living. And I was describing the inside of her house. And in the house that Pedro had built and they had bought, and there was a great big old cook stove in the kitchen, and in the kitchen was also a long oblong table. I would say it was probably like 3.5 feet wide by probably about 7 feet long. And in the center of that table, she kept certain things, staples, like sugar, and I remember a glass full of spoons, and always jams that she'd made, and there was an open pitcher of wine there, and I think there was butter laying there on a plate, and she'd cover it with a white, like a dishcloth, more like a dish towel, would cover the whole stuff and leave it set in the table, so anytime there was, you were setting the table or anything, that was always there. Or if I can remember her, I'd come in and say I was hungry, and she would just get a couple slices of homemade bread that she'd cut and go over to the table, and the rest of the ingredients would be there to put it together. And then in the front room, she had a rug that was pretty common in those days, as best I remember, like it was about 1.5 feet from the wall all the way around. And it just laid there, was like a not a wall-to-wall rug, because people didn't have those in those days, but it was, well, like an area rug, I would call it. And that was in the front room. And the furniture that was in the front room was all basically wood. She didn't have a Davenport and things like that, because I can remember when she got the first Davenport, she had moved to another house, and she was just very proud of that Davenport. It was made to look at, not to sit on.
And you said as a child she would give you some of the wine?
Oh, whenever you sat down at the table to eat, instead of giving you a glass of water, you got a glass of wine. If you were a little kid, you would treated exactly the same out of that bottle of wine, that pitcher of wine, as anybody else in the front room. And they had a little root cellar in the house. You had to go outside to get into it. And in there was always big casks of wine that they had made. They'd make it out of anything they could get a hold of, grapes or cherry wine or whatever other kind of wine they had. They would probably make a couple hundred gallons of wine a year. And nobody ever drank it and got intoxicated. They just drank it just like I guess you'd drink a soda pop with your meal or something today. I always used to call it sour, but I learned later it was dry. The difference between sour and dry wine is it depends on how much money you got in your pocket, I guess. But it was dry wine. And for young kids, something that sour just wasn't very palatable. But I assume that as I got older, I assumed that the reason that they made the sour wine is probably because it was thirst quenching. It didn't require you to always run back and get something else to drink on a hot day or something. And
okay, so you're also describing Felix.
I was talking about Felix, I was telling you as far as my uncles and my grandmother used to talk about him. He was a man about 160 pounds, and he was about 5'8", and he was a kind of a raw-boned, physical individual. He didn't abuse himself by drinking or gambling or things like that, and he was real high as a sportsman hunter. He just loved to hunt and was a crack shot, and they continually talked about that, about how blessed he was to be able to look down on the sights of a gun and hit anything he wanted to aim at. He was really good at that. And one of the things I read about him being this camp hunter, and even when he was leaving Italy, he was referred to even then as a marksman. So apparently he was endowed with an ability to shoot with a gun a little bit more than the average person would be. That's the way I remember it. He was physically kind of raw-boned and muscular. He had no extra weight on him or nothing. And all the pictures you see of him look a good deal that way, too, as they described him. I think somewhere around 1908, he went back to Italy. And yet there was some reference in there. You said he was getting a divorce, or thinking about getting a divorce in 1908. I suppose what probably happened is him and his wife weren't getting along too good together, so as many couples will, they try something different in taking that trip to Europe, because it said, and I remember my grandmother even talking about this Uncle Felix going back to Italy and seeing the brothers and stuff that were still there and sisters.
Well, I think one of these references stated that shortly after their marriage, he and Mary went to Italy.
Well, maybe that was when they went there. But it was somewhere around, it was somewhere after 1906, because it was after I believe he sold the house to my grandmother in 1908, and I thought it was about that time. I know another thing that my grandmother said, that she was meticulous about keeping papers and stuff, and she still had to purchase stuff, I'm sure she never showed them to me, of buying that house. And one of the things she'd say when she'd tell me that this is what these were when she had in her hand, is that Mary Pedro was not going to, never going to be able to take that house away from her. Mary Pedro had died by the time I would remember that, but nevertheless, that was something that she had those papers for, because she expected this no good Mary Pedro to come down and try to take the house back. But they had the papers that said they paid for it, and she had those very well intact. And so I guess there was no love lost between her and Mary Pedro. Maybe in Mary Pedro's case, she never even knew she was hated. I don't know. But you know, it very well could have been. I had my grandfather, this Lely, he came up here in about, I'd say 1903 or 1904, before Pedro He came up here for a very short period of time when he was inviting these people to come up and work his claims, and he didn't stay here. He didn't like it. He hated the cold weather and stuff that he ran into, so he hightailed it back out of here as soon as he could. But he probably got the idea, and through him, she probably got the idea that Felix was very wealthy, you know, and so I suppose that led from one thing to another to make him believe that these kind of things were possible. And there was a lot of awfully funny things happened with gold mines, claim jumping and people shooting one another over them and all kinds of things. So anything could have been possible to trigger her thinking along the lines that she did. I'm sure that one of the things that crossed her mind, because she was always the decision maker of the family and always worried about the dollar and this here marriage that she had, I'm sure that it must never have occurred to her to get a divorce or anything, but this husband of hers, or my grandfather's name was Albano, he was kind of violent, and so probably she looked at money as a way of getting out of a bunch of problems she had, if she could get a hold of it. Again, blaming, you know, I can see how she could manufacture the story and go on and on and on. And she married, incidentally, after my grandfather died in 1938, she married a fellow named John Zorzi. And John Zorzi was one of the miners that came out of here with Pedro, that Pedro had brought up, and he came out fairly well to do, at least at that time. He was kind of a funny old duck, and when he died in 1950, I think he died in 1950. He left a little map and some stuff for my grandmother on his 5-acre place that he had, and she went out and dug up, I think, 130 some pieces, $20 gold pieces that he had buried. This was supposed to be all this money he had. Well, 120 gold pieces, 130 some gold pieces were not worth a lot of money, you know. I mean, that. At that time, I think they were $35 a piece because gold had went up. And she was against the law to own gold in those days. And she was scared to death. I remember my uncles coming down there and trying to calm her down because she'd found this, dug up this gold in this map that he had left with his papers to be opened on his death. And she'd found this gold, and she was just scared to death they were going to take her away to jail because she possessed this gold. So the one uncle, he sold it to some fellow, and the fellow came from back east someplace to come out and get these 120 or 30 some gold pieces. She gave each one of the grandkids one of them, and I still have the one I had. And I think I'm the only one that does have. Every one of them have had problems. My brother and sister both had them stolen from them out of their house, and there was another niece that got one, a cousin of ours, and she doesn't know whatever happened to hers, and I'm the other one, so there'll be another nephew, and he lives in California, and I talked to him about it, and he doesn't know, except that his parents sold some gold pieces when he was going to go to college, and he thinks that's what happened to his gold piece, but I still have the one. It looks like it was brand new, made yesterday. 1910, $20 gold piece. Now, of course, it's legal to own them, so I don't have to worry anymore. But she did. She was. That was typical old Italian thinking. You know, anything. You didn't break the law. You were honest. You did everything that was supposed to be done. You didn't dream of if the government said something, that's what you done. You reacted to everything. You know, in a basic way that is not common today, but that's when my grandmother was. She like I say, she had a hard, tough life, but I never heard her complain about it.
What about her father, who would be Felix's brother? What was he like?
Well, I never got to know him, of course. My great-grandmother, on her side, her mother died in 1938, and I remember my grandmother talking about that. Mussolini was in power in Italy at the time, and you couldn't take any money out of Italy, and her grandmother left her a few hundred dollars. I mean, her mother left her a few hundred dollars. And there was no way that she could get her hands on that money, because under the Mussolini's control of Italy, the one thing that he didn't let inheritance do was pass out of the country to someone else. So my grandmother was very bitter. She didn't think much of Mussolini at that time, because he took this little bit of inheritance, which would have made life easier for her, I suppose. But she never did refer to when her dad died, but I think he died around 1930 or something like that. But they sold their farm. I think they settled the farm in about, well, it was before 1890 in Edgewood. And then by 1910 census is what I have, is the census is 1910 for that area. They were listed as living with my grandmother and grandfather. There was Dominic Pedroni and his wife, and two unmarried sisters living with my grandmother in the 1910 census. And shortly after that, him and his wife both went back to Italy, and they went back to Palermo, and he lived there the rest of his life, him and his wife both. She died in 38, and I remember my grandmother talking about that money. My grandmother was obsessed with small amounts of money. She was obsessed with them because they would, like I say, have made her life easier.
Did she ever go back and see her mother?
Never did, no.
Since she came to this country?
No. Much. Well, she went back to Italy, but here's what happened. My great-grandfather, Dominic Pedroni, after he got her married off to this fellow, and my dad was born before she was 16 years old, so by the time she's 16 years old, she had a child, and was married to this Lely. Well, this Lely worked his indebtedness off, and so did this Dominic. He came on here to Washington, I suppose because of the Carbon River coal country. And she and her husband went back to Italy. And they didn't come back to this country until, see, my dad was born in 1901, and he was born in Cook County, Illinois, which is the same county that Chicago's in. And then in 1904, my uncle, next uncle, was born, and he was born in Italy. And then about 1905, they came back to this country again. And I asked my dad about it, a little bit about that. And all he can remember is they had two barrels tied over a burro. He said he was in one of them and his brother was in the other, and they were riding on the back of these burros, kind of in a little barrel misshaped thing. They had to go overland out of Italy to Marseille in order to get a ship to the United States, and that's how they came back here. So they had quite a track to get up there, and he remembered doing it with burros. Whether he remembered very well or not, I don't know, because if he was only about 4 years old, so his memory shouldn't have been too great. Then they came to Edgewood and they bought the Pedro place in 19. I think she told me that was 1908 that she bought that place, and they paid $800 for it. And then when I grew up until my grandfather died, or actually till she married this John Zorzi, till about 1938, she owned that place. And I think she might have even leased it out for a couple of years, but then sold it. And then today, now it's got a big plywood warehouse on it, and boat sales, and a whole bunch of things in it. It's in a kind of a domestic industrial park type thing. So that property isn't used like it was then. But it was like I say, kind of interesting as I grew up there.
Did you have anything from your other notes there about Felix that you'd like to share with us before?
Well, no, not really. Except that I don't think we'll ever get to the to the true story of why he was transported to California and why he was interned there again. And I do know why he was taken back to Italy, because he was considered by the Italian government kind of a hero, and they paid for the exhuming of his body and taking it back and reburying it in Italy. And on his tombstone, in it's written in Italian, of course, but you can read the word Fairbanks on there, and you can tell that it had to do with him discovering the gold and so on, the story on it. But outside of that, I hope to find out more. I hope someday that looking around, maybe through this Mary Dorn, that we find out exactly what did really happen to him as to why she decided. Maybe there's some in her story, there might be some reason as to why California became unique, other than that story Stanton Patty tell, which is kind of a mystery. But then, of course, the story you got, he didn't even discover the gold, so. Kind of like Columbus, he didn't discover India.
All right. Doris, do you have any questions you'd like to ask Philip? Well, we certainly appreciate your time and coming and spending some time with us, and we'll look forward also for any other clues that you find in the future about.
Well, I'll send them to you, particularly if you got a card. In fact, I'll give you a card of mine, and then if you get something, you might send it back and forth.
Okay.